Well, we are continuing this series called The Greatest Commandment, and today the title is Love Your Enemies. We have two texts, Matthew chapter 5. Let's turn to our text for today, Matthew chapter 5, the famous Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 through 48. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye, a tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you. And do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. This was the prevailing sense of justice in the ancient society. This law is one of the oldest in civilization. It's called Lex Talionis, or the law of just retribution. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. This occurs 3 times in the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of Moses in the Old Testament. Here's an example of the fuller text in Exodus 21. If there is a serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Lex Talionis, it occurs in other ancient codes as well, most notably in the much earlier Babylonian code of Hammurabi. This law sounds brutal to our modern ears, but in the ancient world, at the time, it was an advance. First, it limited the scope of personal revenge. In the ancient society, if a man got into a fight and he offended or hurt the other person, that could escalate and kind of grow into a fight between families or clans or whole tribes. So, the Lex Talionis, it prevents that kind of escalation of revenge. And, we see that even in our modern times. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Godfather, the so-called Sicilian justice. If one man gets killed, then, the whole family is gunned down by the mafia, right? That's the Sicilian justice. But the law, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, it prevents the revenge from escalating into something much larger. And the second, the law moved punishment from hands at the personal, from the person, individuals, into the hands of judges and the court. So the punishment was more likely to fit the crime when the judge gave the sentence. So this was a good law. It was an advance in ancient society. It limited revenge and prevented family feuds. But today, Jesus goes even further, and he puts a much higher standard. Where the Torah limits retaliation, Jesus forbids retaliation altogether. You have heard it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. And this statement has baffled people for centuries. Does that mean that we are to be doormats for everybody who walks upon us? And part of the problem is the translation. Some scholars said that do not resist is not really the best translation. Do not resist in Greek is anti stenai, and as we know, anti is against, and stenai is violent or armed rebellion or insurrection or a riot. So a better translation would be, do not violently resist an evil person, or do not strike back in kind, or don't give blow for blow. A scholar named Dale Bruner, he translates it as, don't get even with an evil person. When we are punched in the face, our natural reaction is to punch back even harder. That is our natural reaction. We want to get even. We want to fight back. But Jesus says, instead of retaliating, that we are to not resist evil with evil, but resist evil with love. He's not saying that we should not resist at all. We should resist. We should confront evil. But Jesus is saying that when we confront evil, do so in a surprisingly non-violent way. And that would confound and confuse the oppressor. And the four examples that Jesus gives provide a clearer understanding of not getting even with your enemies. The first example, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn your other cheek also. Let me just have one volunteer. All right, here, could you stand and face me? Now, if I were to hit Matt, assuming that I'm right-handed, if I were to hit his, which one's your right cheek?
This one,
right? I can't like go like this. I gotta go like this, right, with my right hand. So you're hitting. I'm hitting him with the back of my palm. Hey, you know, like. So scholars say that it's not really a physical punch, but it's more like an insult, because in the ancient Middle Eastern society, slapping someone with the back of your hand is a sign of insult. So scholars say that, well, it wasn't really physical violence, but more like an insult, especially from a person in higher authority to someone who is of lower position. I mean, that sounds good, but there's another scholar named Richard Hayes. He's a huge, big name. And he says, no, we should just take it plainly as physical violence. So whether it's physical violence or an insult, Jesus is saying, do not retaliate. When somebody insults you, do not retaliate for an insult. When somebody hits you, do not retaliate. It could include all those kinds of actions. Now, turning the other cheek would be an act of defiance against evil, showing that the victim is not really afraid of the oppressor. And it is also a way of exposing the shame and the evil of one's action, the oppressor's action. The event in Selma, Alabama, in March 7th, 1965, is known as a Bloody Sunday in America. The civil rights leaders, they organized a march for the rights of African Americans to vote. Like Martin Luther King, they all believed in non-violent resistance. Whereas Malcolm X, he favored resistance with force. And he gave warning to the KKK that if the movement by Martin Luther King fails in Selma, that he and his followers would retaliate with force. And King and the civil rights leaders, they trained all their marchers never to retaliate with physical violence. And they were praying that the expected violence of the Alabama state troopers would be televised nationally. They were praying and praying, and their prayers God answered. A lot of these state troopers, they rode on horses and with sticks, and they were beating these African Americans who weren't, resisting at all. And when this was televised, people were shocked. And this was televised all over the world. A lady named Amelia Bainton, she was knocked unconscious on the bridge, and her picture was published around all the newspapers around the world. And this really shocked the people all around the world. By turning the other cheek, the civil rights marchers expose the evil of racism to the whole world. And it prompted Lyndon B. Johnson to introduce the Voting Rights Act and the Congress to pass the bill in the summer. The second example is that of a lawsuit. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. In the ancient Middle East, the common people had only two sets of clothing. The one you wore on the inside was like a shirt or like a tunic. And another set was the outer clothes, like a coat or a cloak. And, you know, you wore that to protect yourself against cold weather or the sun. The law of Moses says that if a rich person took the coat as a collateral to secure a loan, it had to be returned to the poor person before the sunset because the poor person needed the outer coat to sleep warmly in the cold night. So if the poor person gave his shirt and the coat, then he would be standing naked in the court before the public. And you know, that's, you know, that sounds ridiculous, but by going beyond what was required, the victim is exposing the greed of the rich and giving the jury a chance to see life from the other side. And hopefully the rich would realize the evil of his own action and drop the suit. The third example is going the extra mile. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. By law, a Roman soldier, you know, at the time Israel was occupied by the Roman Empire, and by law, the Roman soldier could force a Jewish person to carry his pack, carry his gear for several miles. And of course, the Romans didn't want to anger people, so they set a limit to the distance which a Jew can carry a bag for the soldier. So there was a limit. But so the example is a Roman soldier forcing a Jew to carry his gear and forcing him to walk several miles because, you know, it's quite heavy. And the example of Jesus, when the soldier and the Jew reached the destination, you know, in the ancient days, they had mile markers so that, you know, soldiers would not abuse people. And so when they both reached the end of their mile, you know, usually the Jews would, you know, put down their the sack and you know, just go home. And inside, they're probably cursing this, you know, Roman soldier. But then contrary to the soldier's expectation, this Jew says, "Hey, can I carry your backpack for another mile or two?" And he's surprised. "What? You want to do that for me? Why? Why would you be so nice to me?" He would be confounded. He would be confused. And the fourth example is the hardest to interpret. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. And this does not seem to fit the theme of not resisting, not getting even with the evildoer. Because here, the Christian is not the one being persecuted. The Christian is the one in power. He is in a position to give help or loan. So I've checked several commentaries, and they didn't really provide a satisfactory answer. So after some thought, my own conclusion is that the fourth example must be another enemy who has recently lost his power and wealth and is truly in need. The enemy tried all his connections to get some help, but they all refused. So he turns to his last resort, which is this Christian whom he had persecuted for years. And even as he's asking for help to this Christian, he is not really expecting to get any help because he knows how much evil he has done to this Christian. And yet, to his surprise, the Christian says, "You need that much money? I will give it to you." And he's shocked. He's surprised. And there is a similar example given by Paul in Romans 12. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. So I take that example to be give to the enemy who asks you, and do not turn away from the enemy who wants to borrow from you. So Jesus gives these four examples, turning the other cheek, giving the coat, going the extra mile, and giving what the enemy needs. And they're all examples of not retaliating. Moreover, they're all examples of Christians not seeking his own rights, but seeking the good of the other person, even his enemy. And Jesus continues, "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." And these examples and the comment about loving one's enemy, they all foreshadow the event of the cross. When Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, he had the power to resist with violence. He could have knocked all those, his arresters down with his power, but he did not attempt to preserve his life by resisting with violence. Rather, he chose to suffer for righteousness and seek the good of his enemies. When Peter cut off the ear of Malchus, who was a servant of the high priest, Jesus tells his disciples, "Put away all your swords." And he touches his ear and he heals and restores his broken ear. And on the day of the Pentecost, when Peter preached the gospel, many Jews came to believe, and a lot of them were the ones who shouted, "Crucify Jesus, crucify him." They were the ones who had killed Jesus, and they were cut to the heart because they knew that they have killed the Messiah, the one they've been waiting for. And if Jesus was a God who wanted to get even, the ground could have split up and swallowed up all those people. But that's not what Jesus does. When the enemies repented, Jesus forgives them. Jesus fills them with the Holy Spirit. He gives them the right to become God's children. And he is pleased to give his kingdom to his enemies. So his love for enemies provided the possibility for their redemption. And Jesus is telling us to do the same. He says, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And it echoes Leviticus 19. "Be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy." As God's children, we are to reflect the character of God to the world. And the character is manifest when we love our enemies. We're not to resist evil with evil, but with good. Rather than insisting upon our rights at the expense of others, we are to seek the good of others, even at the expense of myself, my own rights. For that is the way of the cross. That is how Jesus lived. And we can get to the resurrection only after the cross. Now, is this kind of love really possible? Can anybody possibly live like this? It is possible, and we have many, many examples, and let me just give you two. The first one, I've heard this on NPR, a Jewish rabbi. Several years ago, NPR covered a true story of Rabbi Michael Weiser, who led a Jewish synagogue in Lincoln, Nebraska. When his family just moved into Lincoln, he got a call, and on the phone it said, it's basically it's a threatening message. "You're going to be sorry that you moved in, you Jew boy." And then a threatening hate mail and a card that read, "KKK is watching you, you scum." So when the rabbi contacted the police, he learned that these messages were from an individual named Larry Trabb, a leader of the local KKK, who kept loaded weapons, pro-Hitler materials, and his Klan robe in his apartment. The police told Rabbi that Larry was an old man, a very old and bitter man who was confined to a wheelchair. He had terrorized many Jews and Asians and other non-whites before, and his goal is to remove all other non-whites from Lincoln, Nebraska. And Rabbi Weiser, he got Larry's phone number, and he began to call him just once a week just to leave a message. And he said things like these: "Larry, there's lots of love out there. You're not getting any of it. Don't you want some?" Kind of teasing, you know. Another week: "Larry, think about all the hatred you're involved in, because you're going to have to face God someday." Another week: "Larry, why do you love the Nazis so much? The first law they passed was against disabled person like you. You would have been among the first ones to die under the Nazi regime." So one day, as he was trying to leave a message, Larry answered the phone, and he was shouting angrily at this guy, "What do you want?" And, you know, Rabbi Weiser's wife, Julie, she said to her husband, "Whenever, if you ever get a chance to talk to Larry, just say something nice. You know, don't get angry. Say something nice to him." So he said, "Well, Larry, I was just thinking, maybe you need a ride to the grocery. I can give you one." And then there was momentary silence. You know, Larry just didn't know how to respond. And then in a much quieter voice, he said, "I've got that taken care of, but thank you for asking." So, you know, that you know, offer of simple kindness triggered something in Larry, and he began to doubt and began to regret all the ways of how he had lived in the past. He's had these doubts before, but, you know, the rabbi's comments on the phone, you know, because of the comments, he could not ignore his doubts. And after a few weeks, Larry Trapp called Rabbi Weiser, and he said, "Rabbi, I would like to get out of this life, but I don't know how." So Rabbi Weiser and his wife Julie, they drove over to Larry's house, and they just talked for hours and hours. And over the following months, as Larry spent more time with the Weisers, he got rid of all the swastikas, the KKK robe, and all the white power paraphernalia. He got rid of all those things, and he slowly began to change, and he began to make amends. He called people that he had harassed in the past. He apologized to each one of them and asked them for his forgiveness. He joined the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and spoke to high schools and other groups about why he had renounced racism. And shortly before his death, he converted to Judaism. I wish, you know, the rabbi was a Christian. This story was covered by all the major newspapers and magazines at the time. Rabbi Weiser, he understood that the love for the neighbor includes the love for one's enemies. And he practiced it. It is possible. And his love for the enemy brought a great change in the enemy's life. Another example, this one is a Christian. The second example is Eric Little. You know, how many of you have heard of Eric Little? He won, well, what did he win in the 1924 Paris Olympic? He won some. He won the gold medal in the 400 meter race. But at the time, he was made infamous because he refused to run on a Sunday. Because his, you know, he was supposed to run on the 100 meter, but because that was his specialty. He was very good at running 100 meter dash. But when he learned that it was scheduled for Sunday, he said, "Oh, I cannot run because it's the Lord's Day." He was a devout Presbyterian. And he said, "No, I'm not running." So, you know, people back in UK, they were, I mean, people were angry. They were calling him traitor. They were just saying, like the parliament, the British parliament member said, he was putting his selfish belief before the duty for his country. And he received tons of criticisms. But those complaints soon turned into cheers when he won the 200-meter bronze medal and then later won the 400-meter gold medal. And in 1925, not long after he won the gold medal, Eric went to China to serve as a missionary, just like his parents did. At a school in Tianjin, Eric taught science and math. He coached the youth sports and led Bible studies. And he got ordained as a Presbyterian pastor in 1932. He got married in 1934, had three children. But in 1937, the Japanese army invaded China. And as life became more difficult in China, Eric sent his pregnant wife and his two kids back home. But he stayed behind to work with his brother, who was a medical doctor. And they went to village after village. So whenever his brother healed a person, he preached the good news in Chinese. So that's how they worked together. But in 1943, just as Eric was thinking about going back home, the Japanese army moved into his province and into the mission station. And he was sent along with 2,000 other Westerners to the Waixian Japanese internment camp. And there, Eric Little quickly became a leader and a favorite among the youth, who called him Uncle Eric. And despite his previous stance on not playing sports on Sunday, he organized sports on Sundays because he believed that the youth, you know, had to be kept busy, otherwise they would cause trouble. So he even played sports on Sundays for his youth. And he taught science and math and led Bible studies. And after nearly 2 years in the camp, his health declined rapidly. And he died in 1945. And the autopsy revealed that he had a brain tumor. And many teenagers who survived the camp testified to Eric's joyful and godly life. One of them is Eric McCaff. And he recalls Little giving him a pair of running shoes that he himself had fixed. McCaff goes on to say, "The best thing, however, that I received from Eric was his baton of forgiveness. He taught me to love my enemies, the Japanese army, and to pray for them. And true to his words, true to his prayer, after the war, Eric McCaff returns to Japan, and he serves in Japan for 40 years as a missionary." Eric Little's life was short, only 43 years, yet his legacy lives on. Most people know him as a winner of an Olympic medal, but those who knew Eric remember him as a joyful and a godly man who loved all kinds of people, even his enemies. Now let us turn to our lives. Let us consider ourselves. As parents, what do we teach our children? When a bully hits you at school, you hit him harder, right? Is that what we teach our children? Or do we tell our kids to, if something like that ever happens, God forbid, to report to the authorities, to report to the teacher, so that justice would be put into the hands of the authorities and the person, the kid, would not take matters into his own hand? You know, we might be putting too much pressure on our kids by telling them to show kindness to your bully in front of all the other school kids, but we can at least teach them to pray for those who hate them, pray for those who persecute them at school. In our life, there might be other people in our, you know, college campuses or in our workplace, even in our neighborhood, who just hate us for no reason. They might hate us because we're Christians, because we're Asians, just because we're different. How do we relate with those people around us? Do we try to get even with them, just waiting for the right moment? Although it is against our human nature, the Christian response is not to retaliate, but to resist with creative love. The way to start loving our enemies is by praying for them, just as Jesus prayed for his persecutors on the cross. And we can be honest, God, I hate that person. I can't stand that person, but would you help me to love as Jesus has loved me, even while I was a sinner and your enemy? Help me to show your love to my persecutor. And as we obey our Father in loving our enemies, God may change the enemy's heart. And who knows, our enemy might be turned into our friend and even fellow members of God's church. Who is the enemy that God is calling you to love this week? Let's pray.